This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We have a very special program for you tonight. On April 13th of 2013, two very special poets read at the Word Temple Poetry Series in Sebastopol, California. Dana Gioia, and all the way from Sweden, Shell Espmark. People have been stopping me on the streets, literally, asking me when I'm going to air the recording of those readings. Well, tonight is the night. I am not going to take the time to introduce each poet right now because I did that at the series. So let's move on right now to the Word Temple Poetry Series with Dana Gioia and Shell Espmark. Dana Gioia is the author of four poetry collections, including Interrogations at Noon, winner of the American Book Award, and his most recent collection, Pity the Beautiful. He's the author of three books of essays, including the very much discussed Can Poetry Matter, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. A graduate of Stanford Business School, perhaps, quote, the only person in history who went to business school to be a poet, he served as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009. He currently lectures at the University of Southern California as the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture, but fortunately for us, he lives right here in Sonoma County. Those of you who have been coming here for a long time, some of you fairly religiously for almost 8 years now, know that I am rarely left speechless when it comes to introducing a book of poems. But this is where I find myself tonight, which probably means I'm going to talk longer than usual when I introduce him. Speechless is what happens not necessarily when you're struck dumb or struck by lightning. Sometimes you're left speechless by being struck by a kind of clarity. And this is where I am. I'm struck by the clarity of poetry's potential, by what poetry can be when I read Pity the Beautiful. True confession, the first three times that I read Pity the Beautiful, I cried. Every time. And I think when you read it, you may too. There is, for sure, a generous amount of sadness in the book, from the death of classical music on the radio to the death of a child. There are all kinds of dead people walking through the book. But the tears don't come just from sadness. They come from almost ecstasy of knowing what, I don't know, just a recognition that these poems are really among the finest of contemporary poems that you can find. They're amazing. I don't say this lightly. So why do I say it? Each poem, each word, each fleck of white space, each rhythm, each breakdown of rhythm, everything, every detail about the poems is very intentional. Each one of the intentions works with all the others to create a perfect poem over and over again. There are lyrics, narrative forms, and almost forms, and that's intentional too. There is, to put it mildly, a depth of beauty that calls back to the romantics, a type of beauty that infuses the book and us as readers with a remembrance of maybe something we thought was gone, but here it is. I gave a reading at Beyond Baroque last week from my book Cloudfire, and they did an interview first, and they asked me who some of my inspirational heroes and heroines are, and they're real easy to name off the top of my head, you know, starting way back with Shelley and moving on. I have a new one now, and it is Dana Gioia. Please welcome Dana Gioia.
Those of you who know me, and there's actually several people in the audience whom I know that my parents lived in Sebastopol for 30 years, and until my mother died a few years ago. And I thought I would read a couple of poems throughout the reading that actually take place in Sebastopol. The first one, my wife told me I should never start with this poem because it's a terrible way to start, but it's called The Apple Orchard. And I was born and raised in Los Angeles in a town called Hawthorne. Those of you who have seen Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown, they were filmed in Hawthorne, and they capture the charm of Hawthorne. And I had never seen nature until I was in college, you know, because I was raised in a working class family. And I'd never really seen, I think, nature till I first came to Sonoma County. And this is about the second time I came up here. It was the first time in the spring. And I was with a girl I was in love with. And we just took a walk through apple orchards. You know, there used to be apple orchards in Sebastopol. Some of you maybe remember those too. The apple orchard. Well, I should say one thing is that I began the poem and I couldn't finish it. And then about 25 years later, I picked it up. So you'll see it's a poem that, you know, that essentially is retrospective. The apple orchard. You won't remember it. The apple orchard. We wandered through one April afternoon, climbing the hill behind the empty farm. A city boy, I'd never seen a grove burst in full flower or breathed the bittersweet perfume of blossoms mingled with the dust. A quarter mile of trees in fragrant rows arching above us, we walked the aisle, alone in spring's ephemeral cathedral. We had the luck, if you can call it that, of having been in love, but never lovers. The bright flame burning, fed by pure desire, nothing consumed. Such secrets brought to light. There was a moment when I stood behind you, reached out to turn you toward me, but I stopped. What more could I have wanted from that day? Everything, of course. Perhaps that was the point, to learn that what we will not grasp is lost. Those of you who have been in Mexico or New Mexico, I've probably seen these wooden statues that are religious statues that, you know, for centuries have been carved by native craftsmen. They're called santos, and the craftsmen are santieros. And they're anonymous. And this is a poem spoken by one of those statues that is now in a museum. It's a statue of an angel. It was damaged in the Mexican Revolution. It's missing a wing now. And it's about the difference between an object which is created for sacred ritual purposes that is then becomes an object for aesthetic contemplation. The angel with the broken wing. I am the angel with the broken wing. The one large statue in this quiet room. The staff finds me too fierce, and so they shut faith's ardor in this air-conditioned tomb. The docents praise my elegant design above the chatter of the gallery. Perhaps I am a masterpiece of sorts, the perfect emblem of futility. Mendoza carved me for a country church. His name's forgotten now, except by me. I stood beside the gilded altar where the hopeless offered God their misery. I heard their women whispering at my feet, prayers for the lost, the dying, and the dead. Their candles stretched my shadows up the wall, and I became the hungers that they fed. I lost my left wing in the revolution. Even a saint can savor irony. When troops were sent to vandalize the chapel, they hit me once, almost apologetically. For even the godless feel something in a church, a twinge of hope, fear, who knows what it is, a trembling unaccounted by their laws, an ancient memory that they can't dismiss. There is so much I must tell God. The howling of the damned can't reach so high, but I stand here like a dead thing nailed to a perch. a crippled saint against a painted sky. I'm in a really good mood today because after feeling like a failure for several weeks, I actually was able to complete the second scene of a libretto I'm writing for a composer, and I just feel like I'm actually productive for once. And I've done a lot of work with composers. In fact, I enjoy working with composers. It's an opera song. And there's a woman, a jazz pianist named Helen Sung, and she and I are working together on a jazz song cycle. And I mean, a jazz song cycle sounds pretty cool, don't you think? The trouble is neither she nor I know exactly what a jazz song cycle really is. So we're trying to figure out what would it sound like? It's not going to sound like Franz Schubert, and probably not going to sound quite like Billie Holiday. So I wrote a poem to try to create a poem that was as transparent as a lyric. And one of the things I like about songs is they use slang, which is what we use in everyday conversation, but doesn't tend to get into poetry much. And so in this poem, I've used the slang from my dad's generation, from my generation, and from my two sons' generations. Pity the beautiful. Pity the beautiful. The dolls and the dishes, the babes with big daddies, granting their wishes. Pity the pretty boys, the hunks and Apollos, the golden lads whom success always follows, the hotties, the knockouts, the tens out of ten, the drop-dead gorgeous, the great leading men. Pity the faded, the bloated, the blousy, the paunchy Adonis whose luck's turned lousy. Pity the gods, no longer divine. Pity the night, the stars lose their shine. This is a poem I don't think it'll need any explanation at all, except I guess perhaps to Kennedy, which is that when your parents die, one of the things you do is sort of clean the house out and you find all kinds of stuff. And this is just called, much of this takes place in Courthouse Square in Santa Rosa. I borrow some details from it. Finding a box of family letters. The dead say little in their letters they haven't said before. We find no secrets. And yet how different every sentence sounds, heard across the years. My father breaks my heart simply by being so young and handsome. He's half my age. Look at him there with his jet black hair in his navy uniform, grinning beside his dive bomber. Come back, Dad, I want to shout. He says he misses all of us, though I haven't yet been born. He writes from places I never knew he saw, and everyone he mentions now is dead. There is a large, long photograph curled like a diploma, a banquet 60 years ago. My parents sit uncomfortably among tables of dark-suited strangers. The mildewed paper reeks of regret. I wonder what song the band was playing just out of frame, as the photographer arranged your smiles, a waltz, a foxtrot. Get out there on the floor and dance. You don't have forever. What does it cost to mail a postcard to the underworld? I'll buy a penny stamp from World War II and mail it downtown at the old post office just as the courthouse clock strikes 12. Surely the ghost of some postal worker still makes his nightly rounds, his routine too tedious for him to notice when it ended. He works so slowly he moves back in time, carrying our dead letters to their lost addresses. It's silly to get sentimental. The dead have moved on, so should we. But isn't it equally simple-minded to miss the special expertise of the departed in clarifying our long-term plans? They never let us forget that the line between them and us is only temporary. Get out there and dance, the letters shout, adding Love always, can't wait to get home, and soon we shall be. See you there. One of the psychological hazards and ecstasies of poetry is that when you start to write a poem, as you're first working on it, you're sure it's going to be the greatest poem ever written. You know, and you just see it beaming with and radiant with meaning. As you, you know, come back to it, it doesn't often seem so good. But what keeps us going is the assurance that the next poem we write will be perfect. And I've taken the liberty of describing my next poem in a poem called The Next Poem. How much better it seems now than when it is finally done. The unforgettable first line, the cunning way the stanzas run. The rhymes, soft-spoken and suggestive, are barely audible at first. An appetite not yet acknowledged, like the inkling of a thirst, while gradually the form appears. As each line is coaxed aloud, the architecture of a room seen from the middle of a crowd. The music, that of common speech, that's slanted so that each detail sounds unexpected as a sharp inserted in its simple scale, no jumble box of imagery dumped glumly on the reader's lap, or elegantly packaged junk the unsuspecting must unwrap, but words that could direct a friend precisely to an unknown place, those few unshakable details that no confusion can erase, and the real subject left unspoken, but unmistakable to those who don't expect a jungle parrot in the black and white of prose. How much better it seems now than when it is finally written. How hungrily, you know, one waits to seize the bright hook, how much better now it seems than when it is finally written. How hungrily one waits to seize the bright hook bitten. I gotta look it up. It's an old poem. I read it years ago. Where is it? It's in here someplace. The last stanza is actually rather good, you know. Let's see, it's got to be here somewhere. Maybe it was cut out of previous, out of the reprint. Here it is. How much better it seems now than when it is finally written. How hungrily one waits to feel the bright lure seized, the old hook bitten. I haven't been fishing long enough to remember those things. A couple more poems. This is a poem called Prophecy. And I'll use the book. Sometimes a child will stare out of a window for a moment or an hour, deciphering the future from a dusky summer sky. Does he imagine that some wisp of cloud reveals the signature of things to come, or that the world's a book we learn to translate? And sometimes a girl stands naked by a mirror, imagining beauty in a stranger's eyes, finding a place where fear leads to desire. For what is prophecy but the first inkling of what we ourselves must call into being? The call need not be large, no voice in thunder. It's not so much what's spoken as what's heard, and recognized, of course. The gift is listening and hearing what is only meant for us. Life has its mysteries, annunciations, and some must wear the crown of thorns. I found my via dolorosa in your love. And sometimes we proceed by prophecy or not at all, even if only to know what destiny requires us to renounce. O Lord of indirections and ellipses, ignore our prayers. Deliver us from distraction. Slow our heartbeat to a cricket's call. In the green torpor of the afternoon, bless us with ennui and quietude, and grant us only what we fear, so that underneath the murmur of the wasp, we hear the dry grass bending in the wind and the spider's silken whisper from its web. There's three more poems that are mostly rather short. I'll do another one from another libretto, which is this libretto called Nosferatu, based on the F.W. Murnau film from 1922 that was later remade by Werner Herzog in 79. And about 10 years ago, there's a rather interesting film called The Shadow of the Vampire with William Dafoe about Murnau filming Nosferatu. This is the vampire's love song. Now, when you write for music, you have to write a lighter texture. You also tend to use parallel syntax so that if somebody misses a word, they can sort of fill in around it. But most important, when you're writing for music, when you're writing for opera, you have to give words to another human being so they know who they become during the performance, who they are, what they want, what they come from. So there's a text and a subtext. This is the vampire's love song. And if you remember the film, the woman has to come to him voluntarily. So he has to, in a sense, explain to her why he would be a plausible lover. And what he does is he appeals to the unhappiness in her, the darkness in her, which is what's made her feel different from other people her whole life. And what he does is not only acknowledge that, but fulfill it. I should probably add that it's generally bad to follow a vampire's advice. Nosferatu's Serenade. I am the image that darkens your glass, the shadow that falls wherever you pass. I am the dream you cannot forget, the face you remember without having met. I am the truth that must not be spoken, the midnight vow that cannot be broken. I am the bell that tolls out the hours. I am the fire that warms and devours. I am the hunger that you have denied, the ache of desire piercing your side. I am the sin you have never confessed, the forbidden hand caressing your breast. You've heard me inside you speak in your dreams, sigh in the ocean, whisper in streams. I am the future you crave and you fear. You know what I bring. Now I am here. Two more poems. We lost our first son when he was still in infancy. He was 4 months old. And anyone who's lost a child or, you've been in a family that's lost a child, there's something odd that happens. And I've never seen anybody write about it, which is that with each passing year, you'll see another kid that's about the same age. And you notice what your child would be doing. And it goes on year after year after year. And the child has sort of a phantom life. I wrote this poem on my son's 21st birthday. It's called Majority, as in legal majority. Now you'd be three, I said to myself, seeing a child born the same summer as you. Now you'd be six, or seven, or 10. I watched you grow in foreign bodies, leaping into a pool, all laughter, or frowning over a keyboard, but mostly just standing, taller each time. How splendid your most mundane actions seemed in these joyful proxies. I often held back tears, Now you are 21. Finally, it makes sense that you have moved away into your own afterlife. And I want to end with a love poem. I take my title from Shakespeare, who said, "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact," by which Shakespeare meant that all three of them are crazy. But that he goes on, or Theseus, the character goes on to puzzle that in their craziness, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet see things about the world that the sane people miss. And the poem explores two ideas. The first is that we lead our lives by the story we make of our own life. And as our circumstances change, we change and update the story of our life, which means, in a way, that a healthy life is a literary enterprise. We are expanding and changing our story to fit the circumstances of our life, which is why everyone needs literature from the youngest age to understand the multiplicity of plots, of characters, of rescues and transformations. The second thing that it's about is that I think that love, sexual love, enduring love, is mostly conversation. A good marriage is a kind of endless palaver. And this poem is a kind of a form I invented, which is a double sonnet of 7, 7, 7, and 7, with the volta, the turn, at the end of each 7 lines. I change the tone, I change the language. The lunatic, it's written to my wife. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. The tales we tell are either false or true, but neither purpose is the point. We weave the fabric of our own existence out of words, and the right story tells us who we are. Perhaps it is the words that summon us. The tale is often wiser than the teller. There is no naked truth but what we wear. So let me bring this story to our bed. The world, I say, depends upon a spell spoken each night by lovers unaware of their own sorcery. In innocence or agony, the same words must be said, or the restless moon will darken in the sky, the night grow still, the winds of dawn expire. And if I'm wrong, it cannot be by much. We know our own existence comes from touch, the new soul summoned into life by lust. And love's shy tongue awakens in such fire, flesh on flesh and midnight whispering, as if the only purpose of desire were to explore its infinite unfolding. And so, my love, we are two lunatics, secretaries to the wordless moon, lying awake together or apart, transcribing every touch or aching absence into our endless intimate palaver. Body to body, naked to the night, apparelled only in our utterance. Thank you so much.
All right, we are moving to our next poet of the evening, our last poet of the evening. Shel Eskmark is without a doubt our longest commuter to the Word Temple Poetry Series. Visiting from Sweden, Eskmark is a poet, novelist, literary historian, and the recipient of many awards, including the Bellman Prize for Poetry, the Transtromer Prize, the Shook Prize of Literary Criticism, and others. His work has been translated into many languages, including Spanish, German, Italian, Chinese, Arabic, Croatian, and Icelandic. A former professor of the history of literature at Stockholm University, Eskmark is a member of the Swedish Academy and its Nobel Committee, on which he served as chairperson from 1988 to 2004. His work of fiction include a series of 7 novels that have been published in 1 volume, The Age of Oblivion, Voltaire's Journey, and the Bela Bartok Against the Third Reich. He has penned 10 books of literary criticism. His best-known work of criticism is the Nobel Prize in Literature, A Study of Criteria Behind the Choices. And I'm sure there's been a lot of conversation about that one. It was later updated and revised as the Literary Prize, 100 Years with Nobel's Assignment. Clearly, the evening could be spent doing nothing but talking about this man's influences and his accomplishments. But we're here tonight to hear him read from his latest collection of poems, Outside the Calendar, his 13th collection of poetry. It's a selected work that contains poems from 10 of his 13 books going back to 1967. Including Lend Me Your Voice, which I just learned tonight we have available also on the table over there. Copperfields is here selling all the books tonight. So these books were translated by the Scottish poet Robert Fulton MacPherson, who has worked in this capacity off and on for 35 years. We're indebted to MacPherson. It's a good thing that we have translated poetry, especially, as in this case, when the poet himself approves of the translations that were rendered. But it's also a type of loss that we don't know the languages ourselves. We forfeit something, a type of intimacy, I think. So I'm hoping that Mr. Espemark will read at least one poem in Swedish as well as in English, so we can hear those original rhythms and sounds that are so important. There are many interesting aspects about the poems in his books, but one that stood out to me very strongly is this. Inspired by the ancient anonymous Greek poets who gave voice to the dead in the Greek anthology, and Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River, Espemark has the dead speak to us directly through his poems. In the section from The Living Have No Graves, we hear from a late wife, among others, who have no intention of allowing something as small as death to keep them silent. It works. In the long poem, Four Greek Voices from the Underground, the question is asked, do you know it is your misunderstanding that plagues us dead most of all? Finally, although I could go on much longer, when I came to the last 2 lines of the ultimate poem in the book, it totally sent chills through me, and it sent me right back to the beginning to start reading again. That's opening up, and it's amazing. So I'm going to welcome Kjell Espemark up here now, and I understand his wife, Monica, will be joining him. And I just learned tonight that Monica had a radio show, a literary arts radio show, for 20 years, so very cool. Please welcome Kjell Espemark.
I will start by a poem I wrote more than 40 years ago. It's called The Emigrants, and it was inspired by the severe accusations against gypsies in Sweden at that time. So I wrote the poem in defense of the gypsies and this sort of double exposure of gypsy life and astronauts trying to find a new world for us. Do we darken the night sky for you with our jerking procession of caravans, rusted cars, creaking bicycles, dogs and bundles? Do we become motes in the big telescope with our tattered rags, grimy infants at the breast, the unborn behind can't catch up? No, you can see the stars straight through us. Through this clamorous multitude, thin as a promise, and driven away since the morning of time. Nowhere are we allowed to burden the cosmic community tax or lower the value of the neighboring villas. Try in the next galaxy, they said. We are trying. We reconnoiter for you. Our timeless life is an experiment in homelessness. We made our way through your language. Our hands were shaped into picklocks by all your locked doors. Our faces became feigned innocence before all that suspicion. We made our way through. And if you hear signals and car horns and frying pans from years beyond time and reason, we'll find a new continent for you. With my hat over my face, I rest in the grass. It's always with us, even among the furthest stars. Willow herb up through my breast, quaking grass. The front of the procession has the same color as the darkness. I myself am among the last. Hear them, the steps on the gravel, squeaky wheels, the wailing of infants, all those noises we had with us, almost worn out now. We are trying in the next galaxy.
Now I want to read one of my favorite poems of his. When a language dies. When a language dies, the dead die a second time. The sharp word that turned the earth in damp, glistening furrows. The chipped word with steaming coffee. The bright and slightly flaked word that for a moment reflected the window and the noisy elm outside. The secret, sweet-smelling word the hand sought in the dark with shy assurances. These words which gave the dead a life beyond life and the living a share in a greater memory have just been scraped out of history. So many shadows scattered without a name to live in. They are forced into final exile. The sign on the overgrown station is called something with 54 letters, which no one can get their mouth round anymore. That we could put up with, if only all those who died for the second time had not taken the roughness of earth away with them, the green of the foliage, the coolness from the stream. The foot can suddenly go right through the ground, and no one knows what the wind wants with us or why we once came here. Of course, we can hear the birds in the tree, but what has become of the song?
A three-piece poem called Letter Writing. It was inspired by my meeting the great Romanian poet Nichita Stănescu in 1983. He was so sick in cancer at that time that he could no longer have shows on. And we started writing letters to each other. And somewhere in December, I was in the middle of a letter when I learned he had died. Just died. One. Half the letter is written by the person it's sent to. You, waiting for my lines, there's so much you already know about me that I am too close to see. So much you can tell me through my scribbling hand. From the paper before me, the writers are murmuring like the noise from headphones laid aside. Two. I wrote to Nikita Stănescu, not knowing he'd just died. Felt an alien chill rising from the writing up through my hand. Such a lack of sense impressions in the room. I forced his image to appear in the wallpaper, his puffed features which had learned too much, the smile where the poem had vanished, the feet that had given notice to the shoes. But the frost rose up my arm. The frozen words on the page repelled their meaning. Halfway through, the letter was over. Three. So much wiser the writing than the writer. That these lines become more and more oblique and the message altered it into something neither of us intended. The last part will maybe break loose and describe something beyond both of us, a turned away history, so valid that our faces dare to leave us. Then a few poems from a book called The Living Have No Graves. In the first part of the book, a dead wife is speaking. In the second part, that's a new life, Vita Nuova.
Didn't you tell me a dream about standing in a night without stars, looking in through the window at me and the children round the table, unable to give us a sign? None of us could have thought that I should be the first to end up in darkness. I'm now standing outside the house, which came to us too late in life, and gaze at you through the window, but I can't see the person you're talking to. Your words that kept me alive have clearly gone astray tonight. I'm helpless, like an empty battery. But then look up, for Christ's sake. I'm giving you sign after sign, signs with power to reach you only one moment more. But you're staring at someone I can't see. And I realize I'm dead. Hold me tight so I don't flee. Something is forcing me away. I'm astray in the dusk. No, it isn't dusk, more a lack of meaning along a meandering dusty road. It looks like the road between village and church, but it is no road, and here is neither village nor church. The one thing I know is the wandering takes me further and further away from you. Only your words, only a language that knows me, knows every thought and fear, can seize my straying soul by the hand and drag me back into what exists. I can't see what forces me away, but it seems stronger than your thoughts, and I'm forced further and further into the silence along what I took for a road. Your words feel so distant. Hold me fast. I flee.
And the second part of the book is the new life. I was 70 at that time, going into my seventh chapter. And you will hear about the problems of such a second life. Starting to build on the seventh floor with the air underneath may inspire misgivings. The removal firm must hire a crane. We agree, after all, that the foundation is good and we aren't the first to lose our lives. Vita Nuova, noch einmal. We search a caption for a new existence that recalls everything, but there's nothing left. Every word is a diary filled with scribbling. Every word is blank, awaiting a voice. The worn wooden floor is new and holds our weight though it floats. Thin figures crossing the room claim the right to speak. Let them talk. We can afford it. It's that lift that is a case for the censor. A finished life, meeting a finished life. Shall we take your shameless brown dining table or my well-worn white? Before the lamp, there is yet its circle of light, like your smile anticipating me, like my thoughts beginning in yours. One could no doubt have expected the screech of a lorry waved in by the customs, or possibly the thud of metal against wood when the skipper was too hasty at the pier. Hardly these bars by Schubert. Hardly these experienced words calmly waiting their meaning. Another one. If even denied a Mayflower's hour, yes, if granted only a single minute, we must make that minute our life. Not much of a world is needed. A soughing of trees would suffice. But you would be close. The hand I'd lifted towards your face would know nothing as yet. Our temples would throb, our lips would stiffen, and we would check ourselves like that for the whole of our long minute.
And this is the introduction to the collection called Lend Me Your Voice. It was in fact called in Swedish Vintergata, which is the Swedish word for this phenomenon of Milky Way. But as you can see, those of you who eat candy, it's not possible to call a selection of poem Milky Way in the United States. Imagine moments when all the experience and all the values of a human being are condensed into sudden insight. The universe of time surrounding you might then glitter like a Milky Way from such epiphanies. Sometimes ecstatic, more often bitter, but always with a lustre of human understanding. If we managed to catch these testimonies, how would they sound? It is the poet's task to answer that question. It is a challenge I once expressed in the poem, Lend Me Your Voice. The moments which could be recreated in that way form a series without an end, a history on the margin of history. A similar catalogue was begun more than 2,000 years ago by the anonymous Greek poets who gave voice to the many dead in the work known as the Greek Anthology. And as you well know, this was an inspiration for Edgar Lee Masters, his Spoon Anthology, and also for the Korean poet Ho Un in his 10,000 Lives.
Let's start in the earliest times. Although an ice block has saved me for your time, you can't reach me. You ask, who are you? What did you think? Who did you love? Just what I ask myself. You know only my last meal, dried goat's meat and nuts. The last things I ate, though, was probably snow. Beaten by the storm, fingers and feet numb, all I remember happening was a woman stooping over me while I lay crouched on the path, a stranger I thought I had always known. I fumbled right through her. Her face was burning out of reach. She stayed with me while the world shrank to an ice block. And now we're going to Mesopotamic times.
The air smells of approaching thunder. Are we still in the age of wars? Are new heads being spiked up on stakes in the rubbish dumps beyond the city gate? I know only this moment. Pressed together like two dragonflies, we soar out across the Euphrates, buzzing, filled by something resembling sunlight.
In old Egypt, and you remember one of the Egyptian gods was the death god Anubis. I was standing in front of Anubis, a simple Egyptian merchant to have my heart weighed. On the other pan lay a feather. If my heart was heavier, I was lost. Only a heart without stone gains admittance to the ultimate. With tears streaming down my decomposed face, I watched how the pan with the chicken feather sank. Now, Etruscan times, you know about the coffins where the dead person is lying along the lid on his elbow.
When I had stopped breathing, I could feel how you looked at me, and your heart slackened its pace. You suddenly found me that beautiful. I could read in your thoughts. You'd go straight to the stonemason so he could recreate me, smiling, leaning on an elbow along the lid of my sarcophagus. But don't imagine me a stone yet. That prevented you now from noticing how my eyelids winced. They tried to overcome the stone which had already found its way into them. I wanted to open my eyes and see you once again.
Middle ages. My horsemen had conquered the world. I could raise a wall of skulls, claim any woman my eye fell upon. No one looked me in the eye anymore. Yet I was consumed by envy of the scrofulous old man I rode down. To dry the sweat out of my brow after a day in the rice paddies, to stroke the back of my ox and look into its experienced eyes, to feel the evening chill round my legs on my way home, stooped under firewood.
And now imagine a medieval chapel. I was called Maria. I was made of wood, a wooden sorrow, long drawn out wooden thoughts, a worn out wooden womb. But my robe shone with lapis lazuli and was bespangled with pinpoint stars. Once I was cajoled into smiling by a jester who wanted to honor the Mother of God with his meager skill. He did somersaults, sang in falsetto, mimicked all of nature's creatures, was so pathetic even wood could feel touched. I stepped down from my plinth, my robe a billowing aurora, and held the startled fellow's head in my hands. Dazed by his smells, I fumbled in his matted hair, stooped, creaking, kissed his sweaty forehead. At that, an unknown pain stabbed me. I was, for a moment, human. I fled back up on my plinth, leaving the jester shaken by what he took to be a miracle. But the real amazement, the miracle of humanity, that was mine.
Time forces us to skip a number of centuries. Coming to our age, we are now in Vietnam. I stooped along the dark passage, one of a small Filipinos trained for close combat in narrow confines, flown here to Vietnam and put into the tunnel system of Gucci. Suddenly, someone breathing in the dark, an arm's length ahead of me. A click from a safety catch, and my own fingers on the trigger. We wait and wait and wait. The one is thinking in the other, if only both of us draw back, one of us won't die. The past of both of us is gathered here. Mothers, prayers, village school, attempted love, all like a smell of sweat in a smell of sweat. The moment gets longer and longer. Breath draws through breath.
And now Sarajevo. On that day, the gods took the shape of a band of Serbian peasant boys who manned their hilltop artillery, taking revenge for all that lack of respect. Fleering, they fired shell upon shell on us hated townsfolk in the valley. Others will tell you about the sight that met me, but the grenade caught my children. I couldn't even cry, since my eyes were at once stones. Time moved more and more slowly. Instead of sorrow, stone filled my veins, reaching into fingers and feet. Here I am now, a statue of sorrow I can't myself feel. My eyes in the rock observe the new life without observing. I'm aware only of the playful spite of the gods.
A situation you might recall. My name is gone, but I think I came from Washington. What I know is that I kneeled, shielding the defenseless in Rafah, when an Israeli bulldozer came at me. I screamed a prayer for restraint, but it didn't slack off for a second, turned me into a stain in history. A stubborn stain my landsmen anxiously rub and rub.
Now an earlier poem from Greece. Do you remember the Greek grave relief, a leave-taking in stone? The one is about to be lost in the stone, the other to stay in a half-life. Hard to see where the figures could be separated. The one's hand is a part of the other's thigh. The one's bowed head a piece of the other's trembling shoulder. This moment must be not only the leave-taking of the dying from the life that sparkles in the stone and the cry of the living for the part that is dying, but also a leave-taking from the other's senses and the other's quick memories, from the borrowed eye one saw through and the life the other lived in one. The one who's just died lingers a timeless moment under a billowing foliage of stone to comfort the one who's left.
And we'll end by the Swedish version of the same poem. Minns du den grekiska gravreliefen, ett avsked av sten? Den ena ska just gå förlorad i stenen, den andra stanna i sitt halva liv. Svårt att se vad de två gestalterna ska kunna skiljas åt. Den enas hand är ju en del av den andras höft. Den enas böjda huvud, ett stycke av den andras skakande skuldra. Denna stund måste vara inte bara den döendes avsked från det liv som gnistrar i stenen och den levandes rop efter delen som dör. Det är också ett avsked från den andras sinnen och den andras ilande minnen, från det lånade öga man såg igenom och det liv den andra levt igen. Den som just har dött dröjer ett tidlöst ögonblick under ett böljande lövverk av sten för att trösta den som blev kvar. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Shel Espmark reading at the Woad Temple Poetry Series. Before him was Daniel Gioia. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, contact me at khastings@woadtemple.com. Thanks for listening.